The next one, the fluid element, the movement of the rivers, the molten rocks. You realize that in all things you also need to be adaptable. You need to be firm in your true goals, but adaptable in the right, so that you don't just go down with a sinking ship. You don't insist on a dogma merely because it was taught to you. You always try to adjust your firm purpose to reality. And so you have that ability to adjust to life's new lessons that it wants to give you, and it wishes to take you away from an old identity to a newer and broader one. The next one, the center of fire in the lumbar center, the Manipur chakra, is tremendous energy, burning determination. And that's why, as a preparation for Kriya Yoga, an aid is the Navi Kriya, it's called, where you concentrate on the navel chakra. And the technique of that is to keep your chin down, locked like this against the chest, gazing up at the point between the eyebrows, so that your mind is, your gaze is here. Not, you're not contemplating your navel, as some traditions put it. You're looking here at the point between the eyebrows, but your mind is on the navel, and you mentally chant Om 100 times, awakening that energy and directing it up toward the point between the eyebrows. Then very slowly you bring the head back, very, very slowly, until it's all the way back. And then, again, looking still at the point between the eyebrows, chanting Om here 25 times to draw the energy up and to awaken that power in the navel chakra. The heart center is the one that all religions talk about. It's the most important chakra of all to awaken, really. The purpose of Navi Kriya is to give energy to this awakening here. But it's only when the energy of the heart can all be directed up toward the brain that you have the heart cooperating with your spiritual development. Otherwise, it can easily take you outward again into delusion, fondness and infatuation and so on for things and people. Directing all that energy up there. And this chakra here, this center, is the center of air. The element of air is associated with this. Which is to say, that sense of what happens when you finally cut a balloon free. It soars. And so, also, the heart, when it's filled with the consciousness of air and space, it starts to soar. It doesn't feel bound by anything down here. So that sense of, it would be a good practice even to meditate on air while being concentrated in the heart, and feel yourself expanded and free and not bound by anything, so that your love expands outward to enter into everything. This is an illustration of some of the fact that the spiritual path has many, many different facets, but they're all interrelated. Every one of them contains all truth within itself. But finally, all spiritual practice relates to these mechanical things that happen too. Now, if you want only to go mentally, you won't be able to go nearly as well as if you understand that that mental side has its own corresponding physical and energy and other kinds of realities. Some people say, they don't want to practice techniques because they just want to love God. They don't stop to realize that loving God is a technique too. That you're deliberately training yourself, your heart, to direct its energy toward God rather than things. Jesus was teaching us techniques in very real ways when he said that you should love God. He didn't merely use the vague word love God. He said, with all your heart, that's a technique. With all your mind, that means taking all your thoughts and turning them in one direction. With all your strength, that means your energy, to do the opposite side of the energization exercises, withdraw that energy, relax, and relax it upward into your own self. All of these are techniques. There are many things that all religions teach that are just as much technique as Kriya Yoga is. They're just a different aspect of technique. You can't play music well if you don't know how to play the instrument that you're using. This body is your instrument. And if you learn how to use this instrument wisely, then you'll be able to advance much more quickly. This is a part of the reason that Kriya Yoga is a means of helping you to advance quickly. That part being that if you know where to send your energy and go in that direction, you'll be able to advance more quickly than if you sort of try to go in many different directions. An example of that was, of the second one, of going in many directions for not knowing, is to be found in the lives of Christian saints who didn't know anything about this inner aspect. Saint Teresa of Avila is a very good example, because she herself said what damage the spiritual advisors and the priests do in counseling people if they themselves don't know any better. For years, she was being sucked into a state of thoughtless, wordless prayer, the higher stage of prayer where the mind is totally focused on the divine and isn't capable of thinking in terms of words and saying the Our Father and visualizing things and so on. Isn't capable because it's being held absolutely firm in that divine flow. And the priests were telling her, for years she tried to follow their advice, they were telling her, no, the church says you must do these prayers, you must follow these meditations, you must think these visualizations. And so she would bring her mind forcibly down to practice what she later came to understand was a lower practice. That the purpose of these practices was to take the mind into that higher state, but because she didn't know any better, because it wasn't a part of the church tradition of teaching. Now it's more so because of her writings. But even so, basically, it's not. I know I mentioned this to a priest once, and he said, oh, but you can't tell these things to people. Why not? Because you want these people to come to church. Why do you want them to come to church? Because they pay, you know. Well, real religion is internal and doesn't have very much to do with institutions. Institutions are a help, but in India they say it's no doubt a blessing to be born into a religion, but it's a misfortune to die in one. What we need to do is grow beyond the institution and understand that it's really all taking place here in our hearts between us and God. And so, the practice of the Christian saints, what we see in the history of Christianity, is that they have gone through a great deal of physical problems, great deal of suffering, because they hadn't the training to know how to direct their love. You feel love here, you don't know what to do with it. You don't understand that you're supposed to relax that feeling of love in the heart and direct it up toward the spiritual eye. One saint in Christianity, he'd feel so much love in his heart that his body would be literally, almost literally, on fire. Obviously not literally, but he'd jump into a tub of water to cool himself off, and the whole tub would evaporate. It's so much love that he didn't know how to direct, because he hadn't been taught, and it took him a long time to gain control over this energy and power and know what to do with it. For lack of technique, for lack of training. The yogis in India haven't gone through nearly so much of that, because they've had that tradition that has enabled them to understand. So that's one aspect of the technique of Kriya Yoga particularly. It's that if we can understand that to awaken ourselves spiritually, it's not just a question of loving in a vague way, of saying all's Ram and having all these lovely philosophical and spiritual thoughts, but of realizing that they pass through a particular channel in the body, that the mind works in certain ways, and that it's no betrayal of the inspiration that you feel any more than it is if you're playing an instrument and know how to play it well. You can't play with inspiration until you know how to play it well. I wrote that wedding march for the wedding. Louis, are you here? I could kill you. I wrote this thing for the wedding. It was my wedding gift, particularly to Annie, because it had come out in talking with her. And Louis put it on halfway through. Might as well have played chopsticks. Anyway, but it was so hard to, because I'm not much of a pianist, and to try to express to myself so I could understand what I was playing, to play the notes right so I could see how they sounded, and of course playing them wrongly and then having to find out what the right note was, so much harder. I had to work so much harder to get it out finally the way I wanted it, simply because I don't sight read well. If you know your tools, if you know your instrument, if you have command over your fingers, then you can play with inspiration. And until then, I could feel it bottled up inside, but getting it out was tough. By the way, I've made some changes in it, Jack, so we'll have to do it again. The same thing with inspiration. People say, oh, but I just want to love God. I don't want to do techniques. Well, naturally, techniques are not a substitute for love. And people who think that they are, there are a lot of yogis who don't have love and just do these techniques, and they may develop a few powers or may develop a certain power of concentration, but they don't get God. It has to be that we understand what the path is about, and then in conjunction with that understanding and effort, we use the techniques. In relation to that, the techniques can serve enormously. First, as I said, because the technique of yoga can help to direct our energies. But if it's only directing energy and we don't put any love behind it and devotion, then it's not going to take us anywhere. Kriya Yoga helps us to understand so that when we feel this love in the heart, we don't just spill it out, but we direct it up toward the brain. And then we find that where in the beginning, when you feel great love in meditation, you cry naturally. It's so overwhelming and so sweet and beautiful that tears just stream down your cheeks. But if you allow yourself to go further into emotion, then you suddenly think, what happened to that wonderful love? It's gone. And bit by bit you realize that you've got to school yourself. You've got to relax and concentrate that energy inward and upward. And it's a struggle. First you don't want to. It just feels so good. And why discipline it? But it's only when bit by bit you realize every time you don't discipline it, you lose it. Then you draw it within and you direct it upward. And then you find that it just keeps growing and growing and growing. Well, Kriya Yoga can help enormously in teaching you, in sort of nudging the energy in the direction in which it's meant to go. Because the practice of Kriya brings the energy through the spine and polarizes the flow of energy in the spine so that all its flow will be in the right direction. In this way, we see one aspect of how Kriya Yoga helps your spiritual evolution. But there are dimensions much deeper than that and much more difficult to somebody who doesn't know these inner aspects of the teachings is going to be totally bewildered. Santosh's mother came to a lecture of mine years ago, and unfortunately for her, it was a lecture of this type. And I was talking about the chakras and the spine and so on. Her comment as she stood up afterwards was, hogwash. Interestingly, now she's teaching yoga. But it takes a while to understand what it's really all about, and you get hit with too many things that are totally unrelated to anything you've experienced, and naturally they sound like hogwash. Or a reasonable facsimile. It's only when bit by bit you've trained your understanding that you can begin to see that there is in fact something to it. You begin to get faith in it when you see what it does for the people who follow it. Because even if it's total nonsense, it seems to be doing them a lot of good. And I know somebody came to a talk of mine recently and said, well, I don't agree with anything he says, but it feels good. And with that good feeling, gradually begin to find that it's because of what we're doing that makes you feel good. And then you start listening a little bit more attentively. Well, what is this deeper aspect to it all? It's related to the external astrology. There's an inner and an outer astrology. In an outer sense, the movement of the planet Jupiter around this planet, as seen from the Earth, that movement every 12 years, it makes one cycle of the zodiac. And there's a certain sort of magnetizing that happens within that framework, that every 12 years, man becomes a little bit more aware, more conscious. You see this in the evolution of every individual, that the first 12 years of his life is a certain definite phase in his unfoldment. The next 12 years is the next phase. And we've found this in our training of children here in the schools, that you can divide those 12 into their natural half octaves, the first 6 years and the second 6 years. This is why Pythagoras made such a great thing of music. It's fascinating to see music, how half of a violin string will give you an octave higher note, and so on. There's a whole mathematics in this interrelationship. Well, as the planet, as the 12 years happen, you see that at 12 years, 24 years, 36 years, 48 years, 60 years, these are very often important stages in a person's growth, not only the obvious ones, because the child is growing anyway, and you can mark his progress more easily just by the fact that he's learning things and growing taller and developing his body and so on. But, and quite apart, therefore, from the stages that we've discovered in our educational process, the physical, the emotional, the will, the intellectual. But look at your life or the lives of friends. You'll very often see that a person will come onto the path in his 24th year, or just after he turns 24, or he will go through some great spiritual test at that time. Many people I've talked to have told me that that's so, and it certainly has been true for me. 36 often seems to be another sort of spiritual changing point. Again, each one of these cycles, they exert a certain automatic influence on us, which we, because we're very complex beings, intelligent as we are, and with so many varying desires and interests that may conflict with those natural things, those natural influences, we may sort of dull the clarity of these specific changes. But basically, we can see that there is a certain automatic thing that happens. Now, we have an internal astrology which can enable us to advance more quickly by circulating this energy around the spine through the practice of Kriya Yoga. That is similar to the passage of 1 year, or the passage of one sign of the zodiac with Jupiter. That's why it's also, Jupiter is in an Indian astrology called Guru. The outward Guru of the solar system would be Jupiter. The inner Guru, of course, is your spiritual guide. And that's why the inner Guru is the true Guru. The outer Guru is he who helps to magnetize that inner Guru to help guide you in your own particular way. Each disciple of a Guru will be developing according to his own path. The Guru is not trying to impose himself on you. He's trying to inspire that inner Guru to magnetize it so that you will be guided more and more from within yourself. That inner magnetizing process is the second and more important aspect of Kriya Yoga as such. All yoga teaches you to direct your energy up the spine toward the brain. All religion tells you to do those things which, in effect, will have that result even if they don't speak of it. They speak of love. They speak of raising the energy. They speak of heaven as being up above, and you aspire up toward heaven. You try to leave hell, which is below. You see saints in ecstasy looking upward. That's everything about religion inspires you to think in terms of the heavens and that which is up above, that which guides you toward an expansion, loving others, submitting the ego to the thought of humility, offering yourself up on the altar of God, and so on. All religions, in one way or another, objectify these inner experiences. But Kriya Yoga goes on a step further, and a very important step, in talking about magnetizing the spine so that you can bring the energy deeply into the spine. And how does Kriya Yoga bring about this heightened evolution? How does it How can we justify this teaching that 12 practices of Kriya Yoga help you to take that next stage on your path of evolution, as the ancient rishis, the wise men of India, taught? Basically by saying that what this does is magnetize, energize your spine. It's that increase of energy that brings about that increase of spiritual evolution, that hastening of spiritual evolution. By magnetizing the spine, it draws the energy into the spine, and then just as every molecule in a bar magnet has its own natural north and south polarity, what makes it a magnet as opposed to an unmagnetized piece of steel is that all the molecules, or a large proportion of them, are turned in a north-south direction. If they become random in their direction, then the bar of steel loses its magnetism, has no magnetism. You don't give magnetism to it. What you do is you draw its own magnetism out of itself by redirecting those molecules. We, in our own inner nature, our own inner essence, have all sorts of desires that have not yet been fulfilled, all sorts of latent impulses, frustrated impulses, and so on, that take us outward into the world. It would be absolutely impossible to achieve freedom by satisfying all those desires. Impossible for several reasons. One, that there are so many billions of them that by the time you had gone from stage one to stage two of these, the first stage would already start to move around in its own directions again. But the second reason is more important, and that is that the very fulfillment of desire leads us to think that that's the way to get fulfillment, leads us to think that that's the way to be happy. And so, far from really helping people to satisfy themselves totally in themselves and just become at rest inwardly, when they win a race, some woman won a jackpot at Reno of $160,000, and spent it all very quickly because she thought, oh, that felt so good, let me do it again. Maybe next time I can earn $1 million. And so it is that people get a certain amount of satisfaction winning a race, getting that car, doing this, going there, and they think, oh, that felt so good, let me do it again, let me do more. And so they keep running and running and running. And so, in fact, desires ever fed, means always fed, are never satisfied. Where, if you can learn to satisfy them in another way, then you will find the freedom that you're really looking for. Now, that doesn't mean never to satisfy any desire. It means satisfy them to the extent that they can leave you alone long enough so that you can go for what you really want. In other words, if you're trying to find God, but there's this constant nagging thought of, oh, if only I could go to Hawaii. And here you are meditating, oh, but Maui, it sounds so great. You might as well go and get it over with. But don't think that that's going to do anything for you except get it out of your system long enough to shut up for a while so that you can do what's really going to help you. Because the only thing that will help you, finally, is that inward direction of energy toward the divine. The only purpose in satisfying these things is to get centered in yourself and find your fulfillment here, not there. That's an important distinction, an important point to keep in mind. Now then, you have all these various desires. What they represent in terms of sheer energy is an outpouring of energy toward things. It has every flow of energy has its own positive and negative thing, where it's coming from, where it's going toward, you could say. And so a desire for things will find its own, first of all, its own natural center in the body, and it will be locked in that center in the form of a vortex of energy and consciousness. It will be distributed along the whole path of your spiritual evolution, which is your spine. And so a generous and loving desire will be a vortex of energy here, or an unfulfilled romantic desire, let's say. It will be in the heart. If it's very strong, you'll feel it as literally a physical pain in the heart. And it will remain deeply rooted in the heart. And you may not even know it until something happens. Somebody expresses sympathy for you, and you felt hurt because nobody sympathized. And suddenly you feel, oh, Such relief that somebody understands. This little desire for understanding has been fulfilled, and you just feel this expansion here. That's because in this area is where that particular vortex of energy was, and it was locked. That hurt was locked, that disappointment, that lack of, that unfulfillment, whatever it was, and then it was released. Others will be sexual desires, violent desires, materialistic desires. These will have their own natural gravitation. The point of gravitation will be lower in the spine. Materialistic desires are in the lower three chakras. And that's where their energy becomes centered. And you can see, even in the way people walk, where their main center of energy is. You can see it in the way they sit, in the way they walk. Somebody who's really aware inwardly will be able to understand a great deal about a person just from a glance. Just from the way he holds his body, just from the way he moves, just everything about him. There will just be a certain heaviness to him or a lightness. Ramakrishna used to take people's forearm and feel its weight, and from that he would be able to tell how spiritual they were. Really, it's very interesting that there is a certain heaviness that comes into a person's consciousness when he's down here. And so, when we understand that these little vortices of energy are locked up, going into their own natural field of expression, then we can see that to reawaken them, it'll be impossible, yes, to turn each one of them and release all that energy up here, there, and one or two desires, but it just isn't that simple when you understand that there are billions of these things there. Literally. All the little thoughts that you ever had. I asked Master once, he said, every desire has to be fulfilled. I said, even a desire for ice cream that you may have had years ago? Yes. Oh yes, he said. Every little desire has, some of them have a very strong energy, because it was a very strong desire. That little desire for ice cream may have been a tiny desire, but still it represents a little vortex, and if it isn't fulfilled, it will remain there. And if it is fulfilled, it will generate other desires, as long as you think that that's where to go. The only way out, if you really understand that your goal is spiritual enlightenment, is to direct that energy upward. And the way to satisfy the desire in that case is, what are we really talking about? We're talking about releasing that energy from a vortex, releasing it into the flow so that you can direct that flow upward. Here you are, every one of you, trying to develop in some way. You wouldn't be here if it weren't true. And presumably everybody in this room wants to develop spiritually. And probably everybody in this room has at least tried to meditate. And therefore, let us say, almost certainly, every one of you who has tried, and almost certainly everybody in this room, has sat there and tried to meditate and wondered why the hell he can't get anywhere. You want so badly to lift your consciousness, and you go to sleep, you think about how hungry you are, you feel dull-minded, you just don't have the energy to get out of it. One thing or another will hold you down. What is it? It's all that locked energy in your own subconsciousness, which is distributed in a physical sense through the spine, but we can take it any way we want to. It's your subconscious confusion, the subconscious bondage that says, oh, I wanted that, I didn't get it. Oh, I want this, I want to be there. I am this. It's also your self-definitions. I am this kind of person, just a physical being. I am somebody who's restless. I am somebody who likes to do things and doesn't want to meditate, and so on. And these are what hold you down. To release that energy is absolutely necessary if you're to grow. You can have all the goodwill in the world, and it isn't going to work for you if you've got all that energy here pulling you back, pulling you down. It just isn't going to happen. You've got to, in addition to wanting good things and reading good books, and it all feels so good, and then you sit down to meditate and do it yourself, and you realize, God, you're nowhere. You read about these saints who went into the Himalayas and they suddenly had this great enlightenment. You think, oh, that's for me. Wow. You sit and what happens? You can't just have beautiful philosophical thoughts. It isn't enough to be on the path. You've got to understand what the obstacles are. And the trouble with those obstacles is that they're all of them in your subconscious mind. They're all of them there, tugging you downward with the weight of their own energy. The way out of it is to be able to direct that flow upward, to release it in an upward way. Merely releasing it so that you can get it involved again in something else outward, that's not going to work for very long. It'll feel good for a bit. You satisfy a desire and, oh, it feels so great. But then what happened to all that energy? It merely found its own, found a new thing to latch onto. So it feels, people who like to satisfy their desires, they do so because of the release of energy that they get in the fulfillment of it. But unless they know how to turn that energy upward, it's very soon going to dissipate itself again, and the grandfather will probably have 20 offspring, 20 descendants or 100 descendants. The one desire fulfilled may lead to 100 desires suddenly all twirling away again in their little vortices of locked and unfulfilled energy. What you can do, however, is understand that a strong flow of energy will help automatically to redirect the energy that is nearby. Just as if you get one person who really wants something. I remember a cartoon that I saw in Punch magazine in England many years ago. It was a series of three pictures in a railroad station. And there was a mob of people standing around, sitting on their luggage, talking, doing nothing. Then the next picture, one person dashing through the station to get to a train that he was late for. Third picture, everybody running in his direction. You've seen how it is that when there's somebody who's really magnetic, who really wants something, who knows what he wants, is going for it, then everybody wants to do it. And until then, most people sort of sit around on their suitcases waiting for something to happen. That one single flow of energy is enough to draw a lot of people in his wake. A lot of people start saying, hey, well, yeah. I know when I lived at Mount Washington, I enjoyed skiing. All the other monks went skiing with me. And after I left, a few years later, I found nobody was going skiing anymore. That enthusiasm that I felt for skiing was enough to get everybody else enthusiastic. The energy in your own spine, the energy in your own meditation, that's why devotion is so essential. That too represents this positive flow of energy that can bring everything else in its wake. But understanding the science of it is an extremely helpful thing too. It isn't as if Kriya Yoga was here and all other spiritual practice was here. There are many aspects of spiritual practice that are a part of the whole practice of Kriya Yoga and very close to accomplishing the same thing, is that Kriya Yoga adds that final dimension of knowing what you're doing, which means a great deal. To have devotion, for example, and not know that you're supposed to direct it toward the brain, to have this energy locked up and not know what to do with it, not even be aware of it. As Master said, most people's spines are spiritually paralyzed. If you could get into the spine and with devotion, but also with technique, with knowledge, learn to bring that flow of energy upward toward the brain, what you will find is that in one deep practice of Kriya, you feel a tremendous release. You've released a great deal of energy up toward the brain, and you come out of that just feeling great. Because some of these little vortices already have been nudged into joining that mainstream of energy. Even without your knowing about them consciously, they will join the flow and all start moving toward the brain. You'll be releasing them from their little bondage of vortex, of closed energy. It will also happen this way, and this is an interesting thing that you'll observe, that sometimes you'll come out of Kriya and suddenly you'll have a desire you didn't even know you'd ever had. Have you had that experience? From the chuckling, I suspect some people have noticed this. What you've done is you've released this flow of energy and this thought into the brain. And normally when you're practicing Kriya, if you're doing it deeply, if you put a seed in soil that isn't good soil, isn't compatible with its growth, it'll die. And so, if the mind is very still and concentrated and uplifted, then that seed comes up into the brain and dies. There's nothing for it to feed on, and nothing for it to grow in, germinate in, and so it disappears. The energy is dissipated into just consciousness. But if your mind is a little bit restless or a little bit in tune with that thought to begin with, then that thought will become strong. Some people, when they have that, they'll say, oh, I've got to stop meditating. That's not right. In fact, it's the practice of Kriya, continued practice of Kriya, that will give you the energy to just dissipate all that. You will indeed find that during your meditations, there will come times of deep restlessness, sort of psychic bombs will be exploding inside you. But if you just keep trying and keep going, it'll disappear. You'll think, oh, I couldn't shake this one. But you keep going and suddenly you don't even remember it. It's vanished. So the way out of it is to bring that energy up into the brain and keep the brain uplifted, keep the brain in the thought of God. And with more and more kriyas, more and more energy, gradually these things just dissipate and you find yourself becoming clearer and clearer until finally there's no obstruction to that total upward flow of energy toward the divine, toward your own true source. Now that is the subtle, the spiritual science of Kriya Yoga, that it releases these blocks, these vortices of energy in the spine, and teaches you to direct that energy upward toward the brain so that you will be able to be totally in your highest reality. You've shed all these different koshas, you've shed all these different sheaths, and you realize that you are one with the infinite light. Now, a very interesting point is raised by this whole discussion, and that is that if you could teach Kriya to the animals, or if you could teach Kriya to some being who's just come up from the animal level and hasn't got all this bad karma, wouldn't it be lovely? He'd spare himself all this agony, all this accumulation of ignorance that we've managed to acquire through so many incarnations of being bumbling human beings. In fact, Lahiri Mahasaya was working out a technique for liberating animals, and it wasn't the time. That's what Master said. Another interesting thing, and I'm telling you a few far-out things today. Well, a guy has to have some fun. Ramana Maharshi, a great saint in India, had a cow that he liberated. It's an intriguing thought. The only problem is that you get a person far enough down the scale of spiritual evolution and he hasn't learned through suffering yet. He hasn't come to understand and hasn't reached that point of wisdom where he knows that he shouldn't try all those other things. And so you talk to somebody who's a very primitive kind of person as far as spiritual understanding goes. He's a natural sort of noble savage type in the sense that he has lots of intuition. The average very primitive human being is very close to a saint in certain ways, except that he doesn't know what it's all about. But he has a great deal of intuitive ability. They talk of preternatural powers. There's an account in Morning of the Magicians of a woman who used to, when her husband went to the market, if there was something that he didn't have on his list to buy, she'd go to the tree at the bottom of the garden and call him up. And somebody said, well, why do you use a tree? She said, well, sir, you see, it's because we're poor. We can't afford a telephone. But apparently that was just her focus of psychic energy. And through that tree, she was able to communicate with his consciousness. When I visited Bali, I found people there back in 1958, very primitive in spiritual unfoldment. And yet, very spiritual in another way. Very aware. They were aware of all sorts of forces behind matter. There was a man, for example, who was being bothered by various spirits. And he did some sort of a ceremony at four corners of his property that was to appease these spirits, and suddenly everything worked well, and his chickens stopped dying, and his cows started giving milk, and weird stories you hear as you travel around the world and meet different peoples. But the thing that you understand, too, is that these primitive peoples, and they are primitive in the sense that they haven't developed our complexity, our delusions, our desires, our confusion, and our suffering. It's our suffering that makes us turn around finally. They haven't suffered, and they don't know any better. And because of that, usually to the extent of saying always. I remember one time I asked Master, does it always take a long, long time to find God? And he said, yes. It needn't. Theoretically, you should be able to understand that time isn't real anyway. That it doesn't take time, except because you think that it takes time, because you're bound by the delusion of time. Theoretically, you should be able to say, in this moment, I am one with God, and make it so. But because you're hypnotized by time, because you're hypnotized by all the accumulation of identities and references and relationships and so on, therefore, it does take time. And so he said, in reality, it always happens that desires for this thing and that thing take them away again and again. And bit by bit, they learn through suffering that, no, I shouldn't have gone that way. I shouldn't have gone the other way. Even after they come on the path, it takes a long time. Because they still need to go through those experiences. I've seen people really sincere on the path, and then suddenly they get the opportunity, or think they have the opportunity, to become, let's say, a famous pianist. Oh, wow, that's so wonderful. I'm going to go out and be a pianist. Look at that nun, the singing nun. She wrote that Dominique. Very sweet little song, very gay and happy, but she sort of got dreams of glory of being a singer and being able to convert people through song. Maybe it was good, I don't know, but I read years later that she wasn't really accomplishing anything. And so maybe it wasn't good. I can see how if there was truly a pure motive of wanting to help through a gift that she had, it could have been good. But maybe also there was an admixture of the desire for fame. A very typical thing for taking people off the path for a few incarnations. Oh, yeah. I remember when Mr. Cuaron met Master, and Master said, I lost sight of you for a few incarnations. Now, he said, I'll never lose you again. And every now and then, whenever they'd be together, Mr. Cuaron said, remember, Master, you promised. No, I won't lose you. But this desire for name, for fame, for power, for position, for whatever it might be, all the desires to which the flesh is heir, these things can take us off again and again. It takes a long time to suffer enough to reach the point where you know that that's not the answer. And then, why are so many of you young on the path? Well, the way it works is simply this, that you get a little bit of suffering, and your subconscious mind is reminded of all the suffering of incarnations. And somehow on this deeper level you think, oh no, not again. You don't have to go through all that suffering in this life to come on the path. Because you know that, no, that way lies pain. Let me go this way. Let me go the way of joy. But that's why it can't happen, or at least theoretically can, but somehow never does happen to these people who are just up from an animal level onto the human plane. They don't want it. They see all these gaudy baubles and they say, oh no, come on, hey, leave me alone, I want to have fun. But if you could catch them soon enough, maybe you could stop that. It's an intriguing thought. Well, anyway, here we are. What do we do about it? Now that we've come up through what we're pleased to call civilization, and we've done enough suffering and become complex enough, then we have to return to that pristine simplicity again. We have to remove from our minds all those things that we've learned. We have to shed those sheaths of false knowledge. We have to get back into ourselves. We have to redirect all our energy back toward the core of our being. Love is the most important thing of all, divine aspiration. But Kriya Yoga is a great aid in that way, because what it does is purify our nerves, purify this spinal channel to the point where it can actually handle, because all the energy is flowing freely in one direction, handle that tremendous energy of cosmic consciousness that makes it possible for us to enter into the high state of